Welcome to Switchblade Sisters, where women get together to slice and dice our favorite action and genre films. I'm film critic April Wolf. Every week, I invite a new female filmmaker on, a writer, director, actor, producer, and we talk in depth about one of their fave genre films, maybe one that influenced their own work in a weird way. And today, I'm so honored and excited to have writer-director Deborah Granick here with me. Hello, Deborah.
Hello.
For those of you who aren't familiar with Deborah's work, what are you doing with your lives? But still, let me give you a quick rundown on her work. Deborah was a Boston independent filmmaker before she picked up and left for NYU's grad program. Her first short film there, Snake Feed, was accepted into the Sundance Labs, where she developed the concept into her first narrative feature, Down to the Bone, released in 2004. About a woman with a drug addiction who gets in a relationship that feeds her habits, Down to the Bone starred Vera Farmiga, who went on to do nothing with her life. Kidding. From there, Deborah and her creative partner, Anne Rossellini, developed a film based on Daniel Woodrell's 2006 novel called Winter's Bone. The film was released in 2010 and tells the story of a girl who's the sole caretaker of her family who must hunt down her missing father to avoid being kicked out of her house and losing everything. The girl was played by Jennifer Lawrence, who went on to do nothing with her life. Kidding. Lawrence was nominated for an Academy Award, as was Deborah's film and screenplay. From there, Deborah switched to gears, going back to documentary work, which is where she began her filmmaking career. Her first documentary feature was released in 2014 and was called Stray Dog. It followed a man named Ron Hall, a biker and Vietnam vet, as he goes on the Ride to the Wall, an annual pilgrimage to the Vietnam Veterans Memorial in Washington. Deborah continues to work on documentary projects, but in 2018, she directed Leave No Trace, a story about a father with PTSD trying to raise his teen daughter off the grid when some well-meaning people intervene and change the course of their lives. Starring Ben Foster and newcomer Thomasin McKenzie Harcourt, Leave No Trace has been on multiple top 10 lists, and in my opinion and many people's was snubbed for some Oscar nominations, though it was wonderful to be able to present Deborah with the Best Director Award at the 2019 LAFCA Awards ceremony. Deborah, so lovely to have you here, and I'm so happy that you picked this film. You decided to talk about today, Pick Up on South Street.
Yes, that's a kind of beloved title in my household.
Why is that?
My husband has been loving on that film for years, and of course, by living with him, I've also just, you know, I see it sometimes in the corner of my eye, you know, different things are happening in the house, and of course, we're down on those piers and the steam is rising. Mm-hmm. And then, of course, I've sat through, you know, and watched it attentively as well.
Yeah.
But it's just something we recommend it. We refer to it. So it's just
in the air at your house.
Yes. Yes. And so, you know, once I realized that someone had already discussed Night of the Hunter, I was like, I better go to my second genre film that, you know, that somehow I have an affinity with.
And I would say that it's somewhat related in certain ways to Night of the Hunter and the production or the technique or the look, you know, the aesthetic of it, that kind of
that's true. The true nocturnal.
Yes.
And the nocturnal idea of sort of obscured fog and cloud and things that get in your way of seeing.
Yes.
You know.
Absolutely. For those of you who haven't seen Pick Up on South Street, today's episode will give you some spoilers, but that should not stop you from listening before you watch. As always, my motto is that it's not what happens, but how it happens that makes a movie worth watching. Still, if you would like to pause and watch Pick Up on South Street, I highly recommend it. Now let me introduce Pick Up on South Street. This is a fun synopsis to read because it's kind of twisty-turny in here. Okay, so written and directed by Samuel Fuller, Pick Up on South Street stars Richard Widmark as petty crook Skip. Skip pickpockets a wallet from a pretty street woman, but doesn't suspect what might be inside. The police and the FBI happen to watch him get away with the act because they've got close eyes on the woman, Candy, played by Jean Peters. Candy realizes her wallet's been missing, and on the way to meet someone, she tells her boyfriend Joe, and he is a sweaty mess because whatever was in the wallet was very valuable.
Well, what'll I do, Joey? Should I go up and see him anyway?
No. Come back right away.
Candy doesn't want to track down the pickpocket because she only agreed to do one last drop for Joe. I love the idea of just the cinematic American, the one last drop. And she also doesn't understand why Joe cares so much about it. Meanwhile, the FBI agents bring in an informant, an old woman named Mo, played by Thelma Ritter, who's saving up for a real nice burial plot because she's dying. She shakes them down and finally gives up some info that leads them to Skip being the thief who took that wallet.
Tell you what I'll do, Tiger. I'll give you the names of 8 cannons that fit the job. And I'll bet you $38.50 that one of them buzzed this Miles wallet.
Candy's on the same path, too, though. She goes to Mo for the info as well. The cops get to Skip first, however, and tell him the wallet he stole contained government secrets en route to a communist spy. Skip couldn't give a damn unless it earns him some cash. Skip returns home and finds Candy snooping around. He knocks her out, revives her, and then scarily flirts with her.
Does a beer always do this to you?
What kind of trouble did you get into with a cop's mother?
Oh, a girl makes mistakes. Mm-hmm.
Candy leaves and returns, and Skip calls her a commie when she comes back. Candy goes back to Joe and wonders, why the hell did Skip call me a commie? But she gets her answer when Joe's bosses make it evident that they're spies. Joe's given a gun to take care of Skip. Candy gives him a fake address for Skip. Candy goes to Mo to ask Mo to talk to Skip and tell him not to deal with the commies.
You gotta promise me, Mo. When Joey asks you, you don't know where Skip lives.
He won't find me.
He knows where you live.
But why ain't he here?
I gave him a phony address for Skip. He's looking for him now.
Mo heads home only to find that Joe is waiting for her because he wants the address from Mo, too. Mo won't give him Skip's address, though, so Joe kills her. Candy's falling in love with Skip, meanwhile. She visits him and ends up knocking him out this time and then taking the film, with which the agents ask her to give to Joe to lure him into a trap. That doesn't work so well because Joe beats up Candy and shoots her. Skip visits Candy in the hospital, and hey, it seems like Skip might be falling for her, too.
Did Joey kick your face in?
Yeah.
Why?
I wouldn't tell him where you live.
Skip ends up saving the day by following Joe into a bathroom where the microfilm exchange is happening, beating up Joe and afterwards riding off into the sunset with his new gal, Candy.
I had you right where I wanted you. A gun in your pocket. A cinch for a 3-time loser.
That's right. What are you going to do about it?
You'll always be a 2-bit purse snatcher. I give you 30 days before I pick you up with your hand in somebody else's pocket.
You want to bet?
Okay. There's a lot of twists and turns here.
But that shouldn't deter people, because when you do, when you watch the film,
yeah,
you can follow it. It sounded overwhelming,
yes,
verbally.
Yeah. But when you're watching, I mean, it's just a slim 80-minute film. Something, it, you know, like, it is very, very svelte. I don't, you know, and I think one of the things that helps set that up and something that maybe we should talk about first is let's talk about the opening of this film. Because the opening is, you know, Sam Fuller is really, really great at opening a movie and throwing you into action, not giving you a ton of ideas of what's happening. There's no dialogue here in the opening of this film, only the noise of the train. A series of close-ups and medium shots establish a kind of uncertain relationship between the two men on the train, and we'll come to know them as kind of government agents, and we'll come to know the woman as Candy. But we don't even understand any of that in the opening. We don't know names, personalities, voices, anything else. And just when things couldn't get more confusing, we have another man enter and slide his body between the woman and the men. And then the shots switch to close-ups of their faces and intermingled with close-ups of the man's handiwork as he's nicking the wallet. And the agents see it happen, and it's alarming enough to them that they try to stop the man, but don't make a scene of it. And we have no idea what's happening. Literally, the first words we hear spoken in the movie are, "What happened?" And the response, "I'm not sure yet."
But even hearing you describe that, it's all these micro movements. It's chess, you know. And I love that Fuller, you know, that bullets aren't flying there, but he had a different idea about what bullets were. Bullets are what are side glances. They're stolen looks,
mm-hmm.
You know. And that at that point, we understand that there's something crackling and sizzling between the people. We wouldn't keep cutting between them. And then, like the French pickpocket, you know, the idea that you look at the fingers, you look at the position, the way they crawl to the lip of the purse, you know, mm-hmm. the way that they're going to either insert themselves, and even the idea of borders and violation, you know,
with, yes.
On this digital micro level of fingers, where they are, where the hand is.
Yeah.
And we are, as viewers, aware that there's definitely a technique
yes.
going on.
Yes.
And for those who are not pickpockets, of course, I think it is a fascinating, the fact that there's this technique of how to bump, how to distract, how to extrude. But these are all very tiny gestures. And I like that you're compelled to watch and see how much you can decipher. And that brings us to a theme that I get very excited about. Active viewing and decipherment, you know, I don't know if decipherment's a word, but the
it
idea
is today.
That, okay, it is today. The idea that, you know, as a viewer, you were called upon to try to actively use your mind to connect the dots of what you're seeing.
Mm-hmm.
And that's, to me, a really, I love that achievement.
I mean, do you consciously do that in your own filmmaking? Are you finding ways where you can kind of make the viewers active?
Silence is one of them. And there you've got the silence on that in the scene you just described.
Mm-hmm.
Silence is one of them. If no one's explicating anything,
mm-hmm.
the viewer has to. In the void of silence, we have to input.
Yeah.
So allowing for quiet is one of the ways to immediately initiate in a viewer's mind, right? What's he or she thinking? Mm-hmm. What's he or she doing? Why? Who else is seeing this, you know, and how many people know this besides me as the viewer? You know, so there's this cascade of questions which are stimulating.
Mm-hmm.
So silence, the first level one is silence, mm-hmm. you know, allowing for silent spaces or quiet spaces. And then I think in this case, the shots are prompting you to think.
Yeah.
There's no reason why there'd be a close-up unless we're supposed to decipher it.
Yes.
You know, so I think shots are another way to probe. Again, without explanation,
yes.
just the visual. And delayed information.
Yeah, very delayed. Yes. Like as far as possible delayed, I think.
Yeah, I mean, but respecting that boundary, because too far, it's considered thwarting or annoying or irritating.
Yes.
You know,
yeah.
So it's like it's an interesting, and I think I would err on the side of caution. Because I'm someone who does want my films to be accessible.
Yeah, yeah.
So I can't go so far without people getting some clues.
Yeah. I mean, I'm thinking, you know, even what's relating this to Leave No Trace, for instance, you do have in your opening scene, you know, you have the ritual opening. So being that these two characters are in kind of like ritual or habit of what they do every day and, you know, allowing the viewer to just kind of watch it and understand that it is routine and that this is, you know, where are they? What are they doing? How are, you know, like that kind of thing.
Absolutely. And that even felt risky there because, you know, people pointed out, oh, they could be camping. Well, yes, they could be.
Yeah. And we should say that the characters, it's father and daughter who are in ritual of doing kind of like survivalist methods, whether that's cooking food using what's there or, you know, just living off the grid right there.
Right. In a very large forest.
Mm-hmm.
And yet, because they're in a site, you know, meaning there's you can see there's a tent and a cook set up. One could say that they were camping,
mm-hmm.
one could infer. And so there were a lot of questions that had to be asked. Why are these two people sitting in the woods? They don't appear to be camping in the sense that they're taking a long time and they seem to know where everything is.
Mm-hmm.
But you don't know why, who. So those, the big five questions are there in the opening.
Yes.
You're absolutely correct. The parallel, I would not have gotten that unless we were in this booth now talking. But those opening who, what, where, why,
mm-hmm.
to me is a very enticing way to open.
Yeah, and, you know, if we're talking about kind of slim films like this one, you know, Leave No Trace doesn't have a huge, huge running time. It is very spare, you know, like you're getting everything that you need. You're not getting more than that. It's telling the story, but you don't feel like you're... It's tough to. I just enjoy editing and finding the shortest possible way to tell something and to get into it. And I just appreciate that kind of thing. Even though I still think that in this film, in Pick Up on South Street, and in your film, I still feel like we have lingering scenes. You
yeah.
know, so if
yeah.
you can have the mix of a lingering scene with something that feels spare, I you know, that's an art. That's a mastery.
Yeah, I think that in Fuller's film, the places leave such an impression that I don't know. I've never really studied how long sort of the exterior shot of mm-hmm. Of Skip's cabin, you know, not his. It's not a cabin. So it was kind of a floating
like
raft
a shack.
Yeah. but you feel like you know it a little bit.
Yes.
Because you return to it and it's forceful.
Yes.
So that's actually a kind of leanness where you the image is indelible,
mm-hmm.
and you don't, your recognition starts to become, you're imputing that recognition in some ways because you're like, oh, here I am at the shack, and the shack's got steam and fog and...
Well, let's just talk about the shack, because Lyle Wheeler designed all the sets, and he was an assistant on Gone with the Wind, and, you know, he comes from that old studio time where you build everything on the set, and you build everything, and there's a certain kind of, like, neo-realist quality to the shack, because... It doesn't completely make sense. You know what I mean? It doesn't completely make sense that this character, Skip, would be living in this place that, you know, doesn't have a bathroom, doesn't have a shower. And yet he's got like a, you know, pressed suit of clothing and, you know, but it's a fantastic, beautiful spare set that they've built. And it is iconic. You know, when I think of this movie, I was just like, yes, the shack. That's the set that I remember. I mean, can we talk about that kind of building locations into the story, that kind of thing?
Yeah, and because that's the exact opposite. Everything I'm trying to do is, you know, on a real location. So, but yet mm-hmm. in Leave No Trace, that little campsite was absolutely a set. That was a set within a real woods, but mm-hmm. nonetheless, it was a set. It was, and it didn't totally make sense, actually.
Yes.
You know, they didn't, I mean, well, we didn't even show, we tried to allow in our imaginations for the fact that they had, of course,
yes.
they had some facilities for hygiene and whatnot. It's not showcased. But so one of the things I think Sam Fuller was onto, which is very important, actually, in the low budget world, is if you don't show things and you don't talk about them,
mm-hmm.
The viewer's attention is not on them.
Yep.
So I don't think there are probably that many people that say, oh, I wonder where Skip, you know, shaves and gets himself tidy. Or maybe there could have been a little water. I think there was a water bucket system.
Yeah. His cooler where he ended up hiding things.
Yes, that you know. Was clever. His cooler for, I guess, both things that he wanted to truly cool and also things that needed to be
metaphorically
yes,
cooled.
Yes, yes, yeah. And so, but I think the idea that they're dwellings, non-conforming places,
mm-hmm.
underworld, not always the nefarious part, but more like the scrappy survivor world, marginal people world.
Mm-hmm.
And I appreciated that Sam Fuller was so interested in investigating, you know, I want to say subcultures, right?
Yes.
The subculture of the pickpocket world. It's a profession, right?
And yes.
Kind of timeless, clearly got the attention of different kinds of filmmakers.
Yeah,
you know. So where does this person live? And then, of course, with the informant, where does she live?
Mm-hmm.
How, you know, what are the details of her lifestyle? And I just appreciated that he cared about and was interested in the lives that you don't see. It was
yes.
different than pulling up in the big black shiny car, getting out in front of the West Coast mansion or the West Coast,
mm-hmm.
you know, I want to say the opulence, the overtness,
yep.
the lighting, the fabulous interiors, the big pools. These are the things that are gritty and hidden.
And I'm curious also, I can see overlaps with Winter's Bone and certain parts of this film because of the certain morality code that exists in specific communities that may be different than the morality code that exists somewhere else. You know, I can see in Winter's Bone, you know, you have these characters who are very hardened. They're in the Ozarks and they definitely have their own morality code and they feel like what they're doing is right, even if it may be brutal or it may seem harsh to the outsiders. Like this is just the way that they live, and finding a way as a filmmaker to present that and having some kind of, like sympathy in some sense for, or just an understanding that this is just the way that this world is, you know, that seems kind of difficult to me, I would say.
Very difficult for me, especially because I'm raised so differently. I'm raised in a kind of bougie liberal, you know, atmosphere in which you talk things out and you check in a lot with other people.
Why don't we just ask them how they're feeling?
Yeah. So a lot of processing, you know, and so that was very hard for me. And I had to rely on Daniel's book to show me, you know, how his chronicling of what those codes look like. And they're heightened to some extent, you know, for the purposes of drama,
mm-hmm.
you know, But I will say that Dale Dickey, the actress that played someone who had to enforce that code,
mm-hmm.
You know, she really, I think, did a beautiful crack. You know, she cracked through that. And in one rehearsal with Jennifer, you know, she said to me, I really feel like I'm looking at my younger self, and that's going to crack my sympathy open. That's going to make me empathetic.
What is it you want?
I got a real bad need to talk with Thump.
Now, he ain't got no need to talk to you.
But I need to. I really, really got to, ma'am, please. Some of our blood at least is the same. Ain't that supposed to mean something? Isn't that what is always said?
Ain't you got no men could do this?
No, ma'am, I don't.
You go wait in the yard somewhere by that coop, and I'll tell Thump you're here.
You know, as much as I want to abide by the code, I'm seeing a version of myself struggling, this earnest teen woman trying mm-hmm. to survive in a hard situation. And I'm going. There's a part of me that is going to have recognition
mm-hmm.
and want to help her because I wanted to be helped.
Yeah.
You know, and I know what I admire her. You know, Dale's saying, you know, my character somewhere admires her strength and her moxie.
Yeah.
You know?
And I think this is a good time to take a quick break. We are going to get into some more dialogue and things because I think that's one of the ways that we can build sympathy for some of these characters. So we'll take one quick break. We'll come back and we'll talk about dialogue, and I'd love to get into some cinematography talk as well. Okay, we'll be right back. Hi. It's April Wolfe, host of Switchblade Sisters. You've already been listening to us, but I wanted to take a quick break and talk to you about how we make the show and maybe why you should support us.
Hey, April, will you talk to me about it?
Oh, my God. Drea Clark came in?
Yeah.
What?
I just snuck in through the back. Hey. So, April, I don't know if you know this. I'm actually a previous guest of Switchblade Sisters.
Oh, yeah, you are.
Yeah, it's not a small studio, so you probably noticed me when we were having that discussion. But what I
they
also...
They face us all to the back like yes. Blair Witch like Project.
I like that you said Blair Witch Project instead of The Voice. And that is the kind of cultural insight you're going to get from April Wolfe and Switchblade Sisters. You want inside talk on film? She's got it. Do you want someone who doesn't know voice references? She also does not have those.
Yeah, did you see? Yeah. My eyes went, I don't know.
It was great. What,
is this a horror film that I've missed?
That's actually a great name for a horror film, The Voice.
Oh, I mean, I think that we could probably rearrange the actual show for that, too.
Yes.
I would love to talk about maybe the benefits of contributing to Switchblade Sisters, because we're in the middle of our Max Fund drive, and we're looking for our listeners to just support us with some dollars. And that's a monthly membership that you can do. And, I mean, why should they?
I think they should because one of the reasons I love it is you can listen regardless, right? You can listen to your Max Fun podcast and enjoy them. You can listen to Switchblade Sisters and get a lot out of it. And it's free. And becoming a member and supporting that way is like a tip jar on the counter for the people who are creating stuff that you like.
Yeah.
And those things that they're creating can be delicious cocktail beverages, or they can be insightful conversations with female filmmakers about the work they're doing and films they love.
Yeah.
And I think that's a very cool exchange.
Yeah. And, you know, one of the things that I also love about all Max Fun podcasts and Switchblade Sisters, too, is that we take really great care in crafting these
yes.
podcasts. We want you to get the best of everything, not just filler stuff. You know, like we've got producer Casey back there who's just at work nonstop editing these things. And, you know, those dollars help support him making the show the best that it can be, you know?
Well, like most important things, a lot of the people doing the heavy lifting are unseen. And there's a lot more of them than you might think. And that's why contributing and becoming a member can help, because it isn't just the one name that you associate with the show. There's all of the people and the mechanisms that go into that.
Yeah. And we are already supported by so many people who we just appreciate constantly. Every bit of your money goes into us trying to make the show better, trying to get better guests, everything just to, you know, make you happy.
It's so good. Plus, then you get to feel all glowy and part of a community. And, oh, I didn't spend my money on this horrible... I don't know horrible things to spend your money on because I'm a great person.
Yeah, I was just like, no, I only spend money on great things.
Yes.
I don't, yeah, I don't never throw it away on Grubhub or, you know.
No, never. I would never pay a delivery charge. Yes. This is basically don't order food in once a month and instead support the podcast that you love.
Truly. And there's different levels that you can, you know, support with. I mean, there's the $5 level, there's the $10 level, the $20, $35. There's multiple ways that you can support. So depending on, you know, what your expendable income is, you know, all of that, it's totally possible to help support us.
And I will say, as a producer dork who loves a spreadsheet and planning ahead, the other reason why having members who are part of monthly contributions and already locked in is because it helps something like Maximum Fun breathe for a minute, that you're not wondering like, oh no, I wonder if anyone will support us next month. You've already had people guarantee that they will, and therefore, oh great, we can continue to employ people.
Yeah.
April O can watch the movie and do the research and find the guest, and that's nice. You know, it's like going to continue on and actually go towards something.
The research takes a long time. I'm going to tell you that. But I want to thank also just the current monthly members that we already have, because, you know, it's wonderful. But if you can consider maybe increasing your support during the pledge, this would be the best time to do it, obviously, because there's going to be some benefits that we'll talk about later. But, you know, how can they become a member?
You know, I feel like there is some sort of mass collective that Al Gore invented that might be where they could visit.
Oh, are you talking about the World Wide Web?
I am.
So people who would like to become a member or upgrade their membership, you can just go to MaximumFun.org/donate and, you know, pick the membership level that is right for you. There's a bunch of information that's all there, you know, a rehash of what we already said. But, you know, now is the time to become a member. Now, join the fun of Max Fun Drive. Now. And then, you know, there's a hashtag and things. If you donate, you can put a hashtag, Max Fun Drive.
Listen, who doesn't love a hashtag? But there's also, if you're anything like me, and I just like to assume everyone is something like me, that you'll forget in like another week or something. So while my voice and April's dulcet tones are in your head, encouraging and cheering you on, if you do it now, then it's done. And then we know that you're in for it and you're down to be a member and support us, and it can be counted on, and you won't forget about it and kick yourself in 6 more months.
Listen to Drea. And that's one more time. You can donate at MaximumFun.org/donate. And now back to our interview with the wonderful Deborah Granick. Welcome back to Switchblade Sisters. I'm April Wolf, and I'm joined here today by Deborah Granick, and we are talking about Pickup on South Street. Okay, some of the lines that are in this movie are just so quotable.
And I know you pinched me 3 times, got me convicted 3 times, and made me a 3-time loser. And I know you took an oath to put me away for life. Well, you're trying awful hard with all this patriotic eyewash.
There's a lot of fantastic dialogue that reveals character, reveals their allegiances, reveals their history with each other, all of that stuff. And so even though Skip is not necessarily a great dude, you know, I still feel connected to him. I'm, even though there's no real heroes in this, I'm still kind of rooting for him in a sense.
But it's tricky, right? Because he feels so slippery, literally. Like, I always think it's eerie to me that like his lips are always like really moist.
Yeah, and the film, very sweaty. I think you get a lot of misting on the actors' faces too.
Yeah, and so and then he lives near the water, and there's a lot of mist in the air, and so there's something about, you know, the way that he slithers around, and then his, you know, his actual physical action is sort of slithery, right? To slither into someone's purse or pocket is, you know, there's something about him that I think Sam kept going and going with the idea that he was a slippery entity, you know, that could slither amongst and amidst. But, you know, I think that the fact that he was this reporter, that he could use this hard-boiled language, you know, it's that kind of thing where, you know, you sometimes as a female, I always think, I want to hang out with hard-boiled people and get their diet. And I kind of got that opportunity by doing this documentary with
Stray Dog.
With vet bikers from southern Missouri, you know. I like their expressions, and it's such quick wit.
Yeah.
And I love, it's not part of my region. Again, you know, people have said, wow, East Coast, you need a lot of words to explain yourself. A whole lot of words, it appears, you know, and they would just kind of wait it out in Missouri. They would wait for us to finish, and they could say it in two words, you know. They could, you know, and I feel like Sam is into that. He was, you know, he knew the language, and I feel like right now I'm getting a little dose of that by having great patience extended to me to sort of run around trying to document and chronicle and photograph some men who've been incarcerated.
Mm-hmm. For your next project.
Yeah, the one that we're toiling in now. We've been at it for quite a few years as a longitudinal documentary. And
yeah.
I feel that the guys are very willing to share language with me. You know, like, I don't, it's not my language. But if I were doing a narrative with some of the scenes from their lives right now, mm-hmm. if we were all in it together, which maybe I hope to be with them, you know, the dialogue, I couldn't supply any of it. It would have to come from them.
Yeah.
And that is the kind of dialogue building I love to do, that the experts, the people who've lived it, the people in the Ozarks inflected that script. Mm-hmm. Daniel Woodrell was from there. Mm-hmm. So the base was good. And then they modify. They say, well, you know, actually, we'd say it today. We'd say it more like this. Or yeah. I'd say it more like this. Or I think she's younger. She'd say it like this.
Yeah.
Deborah from the East Coast, you know, yeah. from a metropolis, you know, cannot tamper with that dialect.
Yeah.
Sam did have a root in. He listened. He was writing down quotes from his crime reporting.
Yeah, he was literally recording all of these things, you know, writing them down.
So my method is that I don't have that life experience, so I have to go to informants mm-hmm. who then inflect the script.
Yeah, you've got your Mo's that you have to get to.
Exactly. Dialogue Mo's. Exactly.
Man, the character of Mo has got to be one of my favorites in cinematic history. I want to get into cinematography, but I'm just stuck on Mo. Maybe can we talk about Thelma Ritter? And
yes.
Just the genius of Thelma Ritter.
Yes. Which will bring us to Dale Dickey.
Yes. Yes. I absolutely think so. I think that they're, you know, for people who aren't familiar with Thelma Ritter, you know, she's been cited on so many people's favorite character actor lists just for, you know, ever since she had been working. I can't remember what year she died, but a lot of people might remember her from All About Eve as well, and so many other memorable roles. But this performance, she ended up getting an Academy Award nomination. Mm. And it's pretty easy to see why. First, she's hilarious. She has impeccable comic timing in her introductory scene when she's listing off her prices and how the cost of living has skyrocketed. And also the cost of death has skyrocketed thereby. And then she swings into this very tearful, sweet scene before she's murdered. She's preparing herself to die. She's not quite scared, but it's a bittersweet ending, one perhaps she didn't expect, but maybe one she thinks she might deserve. In that scene, Joe points a gun at Mo. The camera's trained on Mo as she delivers a monologue.
So I don't get to have the fancy funeral after all. Anyway, I tried. Look, mister, I'm so tired. You'd be doing me a big favor if you'd blow my head off.
Then the camera pans to the left. And it looks at the dresser, and then the gun goes off. And it's really beautiful, and she swings back and forth this gamut of comedy to tragedy. And it's unbelievable.
And to speak out loud about the experience of being poor. You know,
truthfully.
Yeah. And I think that is something I really appreciated, that she, but she also knew. She was such a scrappy survivor. She also knew how to make money.
Mm-hmm.
You know, she had developed a small business, right? The informing business, that being, you know, there's two sides. There's always the snitch and there's the informant. And they are the same person frequently. And she managed that. She and spoke very in a very informed way about it. And was so I think her intelligence is very displayed in the film, which I appreciate. Mm-hmm. That, you know, there's the iconic blonde, you know, in this film as well, or the person who's looked at for being physically sensual or sexy.
Mm-hmm.
And Thelma is this grounded woman
mm-hmm.
who is earning her living through her smarts. And I just think it's very, for me, as someone who's looking at older films, it's always helpful to see a really grounded competently navigating woman character.
Well, because sometimes they were rare.
Yes. Yes.
And when you see them, you're like, oh, this is something very special. There's no way that you can watch Pick Up on South Street without realizing that there was something special in this character and something special within Thelma as well.
Yeah.
And relating that to Dale Dickey, I think we can very easily see, you know, how she's worked in your films, becoming a very grounded, even earthy kind of person, that even if her character is not good, there is some kind of realness to her that anchors the entire story.
Yes. And I thought also the physicality of Thelma and Dale, the idea that life's experiences can show on their faces.
Yeah, you know, they look like women, right?
Yeah.
They look like women.
Who've lived.
Yeah.
Who show the signs of time, mm-hmm. you know, versus being artificially.
Yeah, they're not museum pieces.
Yeah, exactly.
They are of the world.
Yeah. And I think people really, the more I see reactions and screenings and the real affection for Dale, I realize people love seeing other real people on screen.
Isn't that insane?
Yeah.
It takes us a long time to realize, despite the fact that we've had these kind of proof of concepts that come up every once in a while, that you're like, oh, that's right. We would like to see one, a woman specifically sometimes, of who looks like they're in the world. And, you know, thank God for Dale Dickey. Thank God for Thelma Ritter having been in this. I think, you know, her dialogue in that beginning part of the film, too, the way that she kind of fast talks and, you know, wheels and deals for what she wants. She's a driving force of the film, despite the fact that she's a supporting character. And that's one of the things that I appreciate about a good supporting actor. It's just that maybe she didn't have to be there for the film to work, but the film is firing on all cylinders because Mo exists.
And she did need to be there because she's the place where they converge,
yeah.
right? She's the place that they all need something from her.
Yes.
And that causes the crisscrossing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
There's also, going back to the kind of code that we have, when Richard Widmark is informed that Mo told where he lived, he's like, well, she's got to eat too. You know, this like idea that, yeah, you know, they're of the same world, and everyone's got to try to survive. There's no ill will. It's just the way that it is.
And that, you know, that's a very perverse moment in the film. And when on my most recent viewing, I really stumbled right there
mm-hmm.
because I'm like, in what world is that? In what world could that end? But what I liked was the provocation.
Mm-hmm.
What if there was that mentality? What if the and was fully understood at that level? That is a very, you know, the and that
mm-hmm.
she just betrayed me and she needs to eat. You know, that's a pretty complex and.
I'm curious. Is that how you work? Do you when you're scripting? Are you like, what's the and of this? Like, what's the what if? What's the and?
The and mantra is something that guides me in everything, and it really, I think, the and is tested and twisted and you know, pulled in different, like taffy in documentary mm-hmm. making, because the and is the everything of life. Someone is this and he's this.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
You know, she's doing this and she knows better. You know,
mm-hmm.
the ands of every situation. That's why so much of life is not black and white, right? We know that these are truisms, but we want it to be. We
mm-hmm.
want it to be more organized. We want to be able to land. We look for ways. That's what's happening in our politics, right?
Yes.
But, you know, so the and is the riddle.
It's complex.
And that has to kind of laughs at you, you know, in social realism. It laughs from above. You know, it's the goddess and she just laughs because you can't solve things.
Yeah.
You have to live with the discomfort of the and.
And, you know, leave no trace, I would say. There is a discomfort of, you know, there's a bittersweetness, despite the fact that we feel maybe comfortable for some of these characters, particularly towards the end, you know, like, okay, maybe this is where they're supposed to be, but there is not a, I don't know, there's like a little thing that kind of picks away at your soul because you're like, wow, I did not expect this, but this seems like potentially where they should be.
Yeah, and the end of even parenting or good parenting or what is parenting,
you know,
he is attempting to give what he can
yes.
guide in the ways that he still can and knows.
Ben Foster's character is, you know, he is on many levels a very good father.
And he's putting his daughter at risk you know, because some things in his neurochemistry don't perform well.
Mm-hmm.
They leave him vulnerable to making very extreme decisions and feeling danger where there may not be danger that they need to respond to.
Mm-hmm.
And so, yes, so the and is a huge part. And I had to definitely deal with that on the screenplay level, you know, because the instinct to judge.
Yep.
And even to judge with the outside censors, right?
Yep.
You know, knowing that people who view this story will be constantly trying to assess, is he or isn't he?
Yeah. Well, and you don't want to project your own morals or something onto these characters either. You know, they have to act the way that they would act. They can't, you know, act the way that you wish that they would act.
Right. And that's where the storytelling gift comes in, right? Which is that then that when it works, we're supposed to dig quite deeply to figure out why would they do that? Why do they need that?
Mm-hmm.
It may be different than our need, but in order to understand another person's behavior, you're going to have to be able to get some insight about the why and what they were seeking and why.
Mm-hmm. And we're going to take another quick break. And when we come back, I swear we'll get a little bit more into some of that cinematography. And then we'll also talk a little bit about our lead actress, Jean Peters. We'll be right back. Hey, it's your host, April Wolf from Switchblade Sisters. And I'm here with D-Unit. Drea Clark.
Oh, be still my beating heart. She did a little pitter-patter for me.
I know. Okay, so we're here to tell you about Max Fun Drive again. We're here to give you the rundown on all the things that you can get benefits from supporting Maximum Fun.
And these are benefits above and beyond the, you know, glow to your skin and the wellness in your heart you get just for supporting Maximum mm-hmm. Fun and Switchblade Sisters, right?
Yeah.
Like, these are tangible items, not just, I feel great, I feel a little smug for how
I help the
arts. A
fairy gets its wings somewhere.
Yes.
Yeah.
So above and beyond those, these are things you can hold in your hot little hands and show off to people.
Yes.
Okay, good. Because that's what's important to me. I like to show things off.
Okay. Yeah. So let's say you want to become a member. You would go to MaximumFun.org/donate, and then you would take a look at the screen, and it would have options for you.
I love an option.
Oh, these options. Okay. So the options are, there's a $5 monthly membership. What does that get us?
First off, $5 is so little a month. How could you not? What that gets, oh my gosh, this is a good one because I know some of the content they're referring to.
Oh yeah, Drea's in some exclusive bonus content for Switchblade Sisters specifically.
It's the best thing I've ever done, humble brag. Over 100 hours of bonus episodes only available to monthly members.
I know.
For just the $5 a month.
Oh my God. And I know that a lot of our listeners listen to this while they're grocery shopping. And I'm just going to say that that's 100 hours of grocery shopping that we will accompany you on. And that's a lot. That's a lot.
The insight of picturing the Switchblade Sister listener at the grocery store, like, I'm going to treasure that always.
Oh,
I want
beautiful.
That to be my last thought.
It's fantastic. Okay, and then we've got the $10 monthly membership, too.
Okay. Ooh, I like this one. It's a Drive exclusive enamel pin. Why can't I say it?
Yes, it's an enamel pin.
Oh, my goodness.
Designed by Megan Lynn Cott.
And there are new designs for each one, but obviously you're going to want a Switchblade Sisters pin because it's Switchblade Sisters, there's knives, and, you know, then you can see each other at the grocery store.
We're so tough. You need to identify yourself
The people listening to the show are, like, wearing cool jean jackets. They're maybe wearing, like, a leather vest over the jean jacket. They're
going to have a place
they can put this pin so that they can, you know,
yeah,
recognize their brethren or sistren.
I mean, you'll definitely want to choose the Switchblade Sisters pin when you're, you know, choosing that benefit if you donate, you know, $10 a month. But at the same time, you know, maybe when you get onto that screen, you can also specifically check a box that says support Switchblade Sisters with your dollars.
Oh, that's right. Even for any dollar amount you do.
Any dollar amount.
If you specify that it's Switchblade Sisters that holds your heart, And is activating your wallet, I guess. Mm-hmm. Holding your heart and activating your wallet. My favorite superpowers.
Yeah. Consider maybe giving directly to us in that way. It helps our show. It helps, you know, all of us feel good, honestly. I need to feel good some days. I gotta feel good. Okay, then we got the $20 monthly membership.
Okay, this one I want. I want enough that I'm like, ooh, I could do this. $20 a month, I could
do. It's a puzzle!
It's incredible. It's an 18 by 24, 550-piece maximum fun puzzle, and it's designed by Jeffrey Tice. It is so cool looking. It is this person with headphones overlooking what's basically the view from the Maximum Fun offices.
So you can, it's almost like you are inside the studio looking out the window, seeing what all of us see when we look out the
window.
You're
one of the people inside the office benefiting from all of these monthly members. And this is the view as you're wearing headphones so you can ignore your coworkers.
One of us. One of us. One of us. Okay, and then we've got the $35 monthly membership. This is nice. This is nice.
It's classy because it's a glass coffee mug. And it has the Max Fun Rocket logo on it.
Oh, yeah. Max Fun Rocket logo. I think it can definitely hold your tea, your beer, your Coca-Colas. I think all of it.
I feel like there's a cool millennial phrase there about holding your tea. But I'm not going to lie. It's beyond me. It's beyond me. But you know what? The mug could hold the tea. Whether or not I can use it.
It could hold the tea.
Right in the sentence.
And at the $35 level, you will get
The glass mug.
And, Andrea?
What? And the puzzle?
And the puzzle.
Oh, I want them both.
And?
Wait, and the pin?
The pin.
Oh, you get everything.
And?
The 100 hours?
The 100 hours. People can get these benefits if they are upgrading memberships.
Oh, that's right.
Or
because the goal is that we want 25,000 new or upgraded memberships.
Yeah, those count too. So you can have new or upgraded membership. 25,000 is that goal. We're so excited. I hope that we can get to that goal. And I know that we can because we have so many loyal, wonderful listeners. And for people to join and become a member, they go to MaximumFun.org/donate. Again, MaximumFun.org/donate.
Do it.
And this is like when your recording skips over and over, so you hear me saying that until you actually open up the website and go to MaximumFun.org/donate. And, I mean, do it now?
Yeah. Do it now.
Do it now. And now back to our interview with the wonderful Deborah Granick. Welcome back to Switchblade Sisters. I'm April Wolf, and I'm joined today by Deborah Granick. And we are talking about Pickup on South Street. Let's get into some of the ways in which Pickup on South Street was shot, because there's a few scenes that just kind of drive me wild in a good way. Obviously, we've already kind of covered the first scene and how that's shot. One of the things that I noticed was one of my favorites. There's a moment where the detective Tiger goes and visits Skip's shack, right? And Skip is lying down in a hammock. And we get a shot of Detective Tiger, shooting upwards towards him from almost underneath the hammock that's swinging back and forth. And it's a really odd way to shoot this, but I think it tells quite a bit about the characters and, you know, their relationship to one another, because that hammock swinging back and forth nearly obscures Tiger's face as it goes back and forth. You know, it's like a little TikTok kind of thing. And I found that really fascinating in terms of the idea that Skip really didn't have any reverence for this guy. He didn't care. So we're looking, you know, up at him, but we're not doing it in a reverential way. We're doing it in a way that's just like, whatever, I don't care. And you know, we could blot you out of the picture if we want to. And I found that wonderful. And it's, again, you know, maybe just another creative way of trying to figure out how to move a camera in such a small space. But at the same time, you know, it tells quite a bit about the story.
Makes me think that Fuller, just in keeping with his personality and his verve and his rule-breaking kind of bent, you know, the idea of unleashing the camera, free it, you know, instead of this regal sort of standard that was coming out of the larger West Coast films.
Oh, yeah.
The idea that you could rough it up, you know, I'm thinking about around him was where people were experimenting, especially, you know, in I mean, Russian filmmakers, you know, you know, so many people were putting films on zip lines, and, you know, they were starting to really take it off of this large pedestal tripod and do much, you know, under, you know, low angle. Clearly, I think he has quite a bit of Dutch stuff in his filmmaking.
And,
you know, so that was, I mean, it did have an association, I believe, with sort of B filmmaking. But it was also the idea that it could be a little bit rough, renegade, a little bit canted, expressionistic.
Yes.
Maybe even heavy-handed, and but bring it on, you know. And I think that Sam was definitely, Fuller was definitely rambunctious that way.
And, you know, Joe McDonald, I should say, is the cinematographer. I want to make sure I put that name in. There's another scene that that I love as well that I want to point out. Candy's with Joe and his bosses. It's the moment where she's realizing that Joe is a commie, even though they're not really telling her. It's just like all that silence says, oh, you're communist spies. And there is a series of close-ups on the men. There's the no dialogue, and that's enough to kind of tell us, like, something is very eerie. Then she sits down, and then the boss sets a gun on the table in the foreground. So the gun is on the table in the foreground of the frame while Candy sits behind it. And the gun is in focus, but Candy is slightly out of focus, and it's very unnerving. it's, you know, it's just a creative effect that, you know, why would you not have your lead actress in focus during this very, you know, seminal scene?
Yeah, as someone who tries so hard to not put guns in her films, you know, I, hearing you right here, right now, I think so symbolic that for a whole just vast sector of American life, criminal activity or not, the gun being so much of the...
I mean, it's gone past the Chekhov's meaning at this point.
Yeah, yeah. But the gun being the way that so much is going to play out in American culture, but that storytelling will become very addicted and reliant upon it. And, of course, I take... I try to push back against that so much. I'm like... I'm someone who gets very on my high horse and pretty animated about the idea... What would happen if you, you know, ever decided to curb that addiction, you know?
Yeah.
And try really using all your brain power to tell stories that don't rely on guns, you know? You know, with Fuller, that's not a useful idea for me to posit. You know, the guns were there and they were important in all parts of the plot. But the fact is, I look at that with this critical distance that, that really actually is a very big... big theme in my life. I am someone who is always trying to parse and understand how did we get here?
Yeah.
With guns being so totalizing in American culture.
Well, I mean, it is a challenge, I think, for writers at this point, you know, because they are so ingrained in our brains and our storytelling. But yeah, telling a story without them and really working hard to do that. I'm trying to remember... it's been a while since I've seen Winter's Bone. What's the gun total in that?
There is a the uncle who's difficult to deal with, Teardrop, he has firearms.
Yeah.
And he at one point there's one on his kitchen table. He's not threatening anyone with it, but it's very much there.
It exists
it
in
exists
that world.
As something that he keeps in his household and then he keeps one in his car, and then at one point there's a standoff with the sheriff. And they are both touching their guns.
Yeah.
And Teardrop asks the question.
Is this going to be our time?
Is this going to be our time? Is this going to be the time in which we face each other down? Or is there a way to postpone that? And because of the presence of his niece in the vehicle, both men decide in a very, very hairline fracture kind of way, very fragile, iffy way to not pursue terminal aggression with a firearm.
And that seems like it would have an even deeper meaning for you. I mean, like with the way that you feel about firearms and stories and that kind of thing, that you have two characters who mutually agree upon non-destruction.
I am very, very enamored with any story where people mutually agree on non-destruction. I must say that is a very tense and interesting moment for me. But, you know, I'm trying to figure out a way to create, to work with blue balls. Mm-hmm. Firearms blue balls.
Mm-hmm. Firearms blue balls. Yeah, I love everything you say right now.
I am trying because I realize I can't be an American storyteller and probably not have firearms in my films.
It would be dishonest in a sense.
But I want to know how can I have it so that they don't get fired.
Yeah.
I want to complicate them. I want to restore, like many theorists who talk about this, I want to restore some meaning to the woundable body. Mm-hmm. I don't want firearm death to be seen as such a kind of sterile, magical way of killing. I'm much more, I love the Eastern Europeans who try to say, what does it look like? People don't die that easy if you don't have a gun. Mm-hmm. Terminating life has to have this gravitas, and the gun does, it depletes it. A machine does it for you. Mm-hmm. You know, I'm much more into like the ancient form of the dress down. Mm-hmm. Look your person, your other person, if you're having that level of intensity, be able to look them in the eye. Mm-hmm. The cowardice of the long shot, of the cloak, the hood, the cowardice is what was what I feel is cheapened. Mm-hmm. Male aggression. Mm-hmm. Toxic masculinity needs to step up to the plate and do it well. Drive by, no. Trophy hunting, no. Cheating, dudes.
This is a perfect segue into the thing that I wanted to make sure that we covered last in this Sam Fuller story of Pickup on South Street, because I wanted to talk about the fight choreography between Gene Peters' Candy and then Joe. First, quickly, Gene Peters beat out Marilyn Monroe, Shelley Winters, Ava Gardner, and a very, very feisty Betty Grable for the role of Candy.
Wow.
And the reason that she did was because she didn't even ask for it. Fuller saw her in a cafeteria and was like, "Oh, she looks like a real woman. She looks like a someone who could be a prostitute, someone who could live among people who's not refined." And they were always looking for refined actors, and they kind of took any personality out of them, whereas Gene Peters walked with a kind of bow-leggedness, like a graceless bow-leggedness that really caught Fuller's attention and was just like, "Ah, it's a real woman, I want her." And so he almost walked off the picture. He finally got her secured for the role the day that they started shooting. But the way that she fits into the story and the way that she fits in as the kind of abused woman in this, and the way that she kind of takes the abuse, is so honest in a sense. I was thinking about it and I was just like, man, this movie is not kind to women, like, at all. But at the same time, the way that this character Candy is just like, well, I guess this is what I deserve. There's a kind of like tragedy to the way that she kind of accepts violence into her life, where she's like, well, this is what I'm used to. And it's not, Sam Fuller projecting the idea that, like, no, women should be taken care of. It's just like, well, life is pretty fucking harsh to women, especially in this position where Candy is, she's a prostitute and she makes her living, on the street with these people who aren't necessarily great. That fight scene between Candy and Joe, however, is shocking because it's so raw, and I'm not used to seeing that in movies at that time. She falls down hard at one point in time. Tables, chairs get knocked over, and it feels very real in a sense that I'm not used to with films of that time period.
Mm. Of course, there's some places in this film where I kind of black out or glaze over, and, mm-hmm. and of course, there's no mincing my words here. That's why all my energy, my psychic energy, my attention, my cinema note-taking energy goes to Thelma, and to the character of Mo, mm-hmm. because that's where I'm on ground where a female-bodied human being navigates, succeeds, does her work.
Agency,
absolutely. So with Candy, I think you're onto something. I think you understand more about men of the time than you can ever hope to understand about women of the time.
Yeah.
including male fantasy. Mm-hmm. You know, Candy is one of the four or five, you know, they don't have a lot of fantasy variations. She's just one of the, she's in that mix of, yep. Of different ingredients that go into a screenplay of the time. Mm-hmm. But, you know, I do think it's interesting that she does not die at the end.
No.
And I wondered, and I've thought in a positive way, that to me was that he respected the survival desire.
She's a gritty character.
Yes, she's a gritty character. And I like that because it's very easy to dispose of women.
Yes.
It would be easy to have her fall, you know, be shot and have that be the end of her.
Yeah.
So I kind of really appreciate that. Not even for the happy ending that it it can possibly offer.
Yeah.
I just like the idea. And also I realize that I don't see too many survival of gunshot wounds.
Yeah.
I don't see that very frequently, so that interested me as well.
Yeah.
But yeah, that the choreography, I think that was something. I'm not a Fuller expert at all, but I do believe that is something he would prize, that he would want it to be quite. It's not just the dainty slap or the
big
romantic slap, that it's
She fights back too.
Yes,
that's the one of the more interesting parts of that is that she does fight back with him, which is something that, you know, like you usually see like someone like take it, but even though she falls down, like she's pushing back, she's kind of like blindly just like pushing his body away, and it's a kind of brutal scene in that sense. And even when they find her body and they pick up her head, and they pick up her head with like such a carelessness, and then they like open up their eyes and they're like, oh, she's alive. And it's just like she becomes kind of like this weird object, and it's almost like exaggerated, a sense, you know, like the way that she's been kind of, her body is kind of moved around between these men, and the brutishness of that. It's a fascinating thing. God, Sam Fuller, like what level was he on? I could never figure him out. And of course he went on to direct many big battle scenes too after this.
Yeah. And it's these smaller thing, these smaller subculture examinations that I feel like I associate. That's where my attraction goes with him.
Yeah. And he said, you know, because a lot of people were worried about like the politics of his movies and that kind of thing. And he said, I had no intention of making a political statement in this film. None whatsoever. My yarn is a noir thriller about marginal people. Nothing more, nothing less. I wanted to poke at the idiocy of the Cold War climate of the 50s.
And I think he did. I think he did. I think he... Really, that's a beautiful description of his film by him. You know,
was very aware.
Yeah,
you know?
He was, and that's accurate. I think everything he just in those two sentences is borne out in the film.
Do you feel like you can accurately in two sentences say like this is my whole ideology? This is my this is what I do.
Oh, I mean, sometimes, you know, never on cue. But I mean, I'm interested in survival, day to day survival, where it's not obvious how to achieve that.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm very interested in how people make their way when there's no map,
mm-hmm.
you know, when it's not been laid out for them through class, through opportunity, through entitlement, you know, when people have to forge that and figure out how to make their life worth living.
Mm-hmm.
And keep the stamina.
I think we definitely see that and pick up on South Street and in your films. And I'm so happy that you're able to join us today to talk about it. And when is this documentary coming out? When are we going to be finished with this incarceration documentary that you have?
Oh, my goodness. I'm sure the guys are wondering that themselves. But before I get there, I just want to say I've enjoyed this conversation so much as well. So thank you. And, you know, the documentary is so far along, and of course this would happen that, you know, about 4 or 5 days ago, you know, I'm filming someone who hasn't been out that long, and he has just got a lot of beautiful ways of being so specific about his background and where, you know, what led to what and mm-hmm. how he's navigated and how hard the transition is from incarceration to the day-to-day life, you know, in the city at large, and
mm-hmm.
And of course, then his good friend comes over. Just, you know, he just said, "Is it okay if my friend stops by?"
Mm-hmm.
And that was yet another wealth of detailed observation and emotion, yeah. And you know, so the terribly taunting part of Doc is that mostly it doesn't end. So it's very hard to know when to say, you know, you're done.
Right.
And I'm working on that. I'm working on that. I have to stop because I have to do the next narrative. So
yeah.
One has to relinquish the attachment at some point.
Yeah. Look for Deborah's documentary in 30 years. And
oh, no, don't say that. my whole team, we can't do that.
And, well, while we're waiting for the new documentary to come out, you can always watch Leave No Trace on Amazon, I think, now. And it's also available on iTunes or at your video store, any of those things. And then, you know,
video store? What world is that?
I know, right? I live in a fantasy world with my video store, Videotech. And, you know, you can always check out Winter's Bone, Stray Dog, and Down to the Bone as well. So maybe become a studious person of Deborah's work. Thank you so much for joining me today.
Thank you so much.
And thank you for listening to Switchblade Sisters. If you like what you're hearing, please leave us a 5-star review on Apple Podcasts. If you do, we'll read it on air. Joey Bagel says, movies are an essential escape for me, and genre films in particular are an amazing medium to explore social, political, and moral topics. April vibes so well with all her guests, who each bring amazing perspectives and insights, and April's research on the sometimes obscure background of the films brings me life. Movie critic April Wolf and movie industry guest dissect a genre classic every week. They go deep on production details. It all comes from a place of deep love for the art they cover, and I learn something new every week. Thank you guys so much. If you want to let us know what you think of the show, you can tweet at us at SwitchbladePod or email us at SwitchbladeSisters@MaximumFun.org. And please check out our Facebook group too. That's Facebook.com/groups/SwitchbladeSisters. Our producer is Casey O'Brien. Our senior producer is Laura Swisher. And this is a production of MaximumFun.org.
You'd be doing me a big favor if you'd blow my head off.
MaximumFun.org.
Comedy and culture.
Artist owned.
Audience supported.